From Studio J, 10 stories above K Street, this is the Education Gadfly Show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who's excited he might finally be able to keep firearms in his office, Rick Hess.
Thank heavens for Cato, huh, man?
That's right. You know, for listeners, I don't know what we're referring to. Recently, there was a court decision that the District of Columbia's ban against handguns is unconstitutional.
I noticed that this was driven by a Cato scholar who lives in Florida.
Yeah, that's right, in a high-rise apartment in Florida. Yes, all of those inner-city families have him to thank for this. Of course, this handgun ban, it's hard to argue, hasn't been terribly effective. I understand it's quite easy to go to a street corner and buy yourself an AK-47 if you'd like one. In fact, that's what Liam does most days on his lunch break.
How many AK-47s have you bought, Liam? Oof, that's more than 10 fingers on his hands.
He's now denying this. He's denying it.
Well, yeah. You know, if you outlaw guns, only outlaws will have guns.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and you got to feel bad for the residents of the District of Columbia. So now their handgun ban has been declared unconstitutional. And the White House has now said that a bill going through Congress to give D.C. a vote in the House would also be unconstitutional. So, you know, what is it with just throwing this Constitution thing at the desire of the people of the District of Columbia?
That darn document. I got to say, though, I mean, I agree with the White House on the D.C. vote thing. I mean, the Constitution is pretty explicit that the square miles set up for the federal government are not to, are not to be a voting entity as understood by a state, unless you amend the Constitution. On the other hand, this the Second Amendment does have this whole thing about a well-regulated militia. I'm not sure a whole bunch of crackheads buying AK-47s on the corner is any real involvement with a well-regulated militia.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think it's probably time to get back to something we know about, education.
But we're so good at what we don't know anything about.
Yeah, that's true. Rick, you know, I tell you, sometimes you act like you're more sure of your positions on these non-education issues than on education where you – you know, you just always, you know, well, it depends, you know.
You know, the less you know, the easier it is to be certain.
That's probably true.
The Fox News effect.
Huh? There you have it. Well, listeners, if you have something you want to tell us about, even if it's not education related, shoot us a line at letters@excellence.net. Let's get going. We'll start with Pardon the Gadfly. Then we've got an interview with a bona fide journalist, Education Week's Mark Walsh, about the Supreme Court case this week. And finally, in-house weirdo Liam will impart some education news of the weird. So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Jen, take it away.
All right. Topic one, a tale of two merit pays. In Little Rock, teachers apparently love their performance pay plan, and it's expanding. In Florida, merit pay is despised by most teachers, and the Sunshine State's program is foundering on the shoals of educators' discontent. Mike, can merit pay plans only work if teachers are on board, or is it possible to force teachers to accept extra money?
Well, Jen, I think this is a bit of a forced choice, but I do think it is important to have some buy-in from the teachers. And I think this Florida situation, as well as the one in Houston, we can really learn some examples from. These are some programs that have turned out to be terribly unpopular with teachers, and I don't think it's just the normal sort of teacher union anti-merit pay stuff. I think that these programs have not been terribly well designed. And just as in other domains of education policy, like charter schools, for example, it's not okay just to be in favor of merit pay. You got to sweat the details.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, it's funny because we spent, 40 years thinking through details of management reform and merit pay and these things in the broader society. And then in education the last decade, it's been like we were discovering these things for the first time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never went to an education symposium on merit pay where you actually saw people from HR operations. You never saw people who actually specialize in designing merit pay from outside the sector. You had a bunch of educators arguing about whether it made sense to pay people who do good work more. And that's, you know, I mean, the other point here is that obviously it matters whether or not teachers like this stuff, but that shouldn't be determinant. You know, you can certainly imagine schools where teachers are going to resist even a well-designed system That's different from teachers pushing off on a system because it's a poorly and stupidly designed system.
I mean, should we even be mandating these systems from the state or even district level? I mean, isn't the ultimate goal to just let principals decide what to pay their teachers? I mean, that's the holy grail eventually, right?
I think within parameters. I mean, like in any organization, you don't want to give, you know, an unfettered hand to your management team to do whatever the heck it will.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the especially if teachers are pointing out the test scores don't capture everything they do and reflect it, yeah. You want a pay system that respects what they're doing.
You know, because we have all kinds of flexibility here at Fordham, I've started to pay Liam via Girl Scout cookies. So actually,
how's that working out for you, Liam? He's looking chubby.
Yeah, he is. And when he doesn't get that next paycheck, I'm just going to say, hey, I saw you eat a lot of Thin Mints. So, Jen, topic two.
All right. Democrats in Congress are railing against Head Start's so-called tests for four-year-olds. The Dems want to do away with them. Rick, are the Dems right? Shouldn't four-year-olds be able to enjoy life and play with their friends without worrying about exams?
You know, here's one of my equivocating moments. I think the debate's actually is even a bit more complex than that. One is I've got a lot of sympathy for the notion that preschool should be about more than reading readiness. And I think, you know, this is part of the whole No Child Left Behind, life revolves around grade 3 to 8 testing and reading, math and reading test problem, that we are increasingly kind of narrowing our notion of what it means to educate and prepare young kids. But then the other question is whether or not these tests are actually useful and sensible. And there's real questions about whether these assessment instruments are the ones that, you know, ought to be mandated for all kids.
See, Rick, I think you're being all hippy-dippy now on this.
I'm a hippy-dippy guy.
I mean, we're talking about Head Start programs that are certainly not going all day long, right? There's plenty of time for kids. Of course, they should be playing and having fun and enjoying life as a four-year-old. But, you know, when they're in a preschool program being paid by the federal government targeted at poor kids, you know, those programs should have a strong academic component. It doesn't mean that's all that they do, but – you know, we got to get away from this notion that, well, we can't expect four-year-olds to start learning their letters. Of course we should. And, you know, in upper middle class communities and families, you've got 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds learning their letters and getting ready for school. So I think, I think this is crazy to say that we should, you know, be hands off. This is going to have a huge impact on whether or not these kids are ever going to be prepared, you know, for their lifetime chances later on. Hippy dippy Ricky.
You feel strongly on that one, Mike?
I do.
You got it. I like that, man. I do. You light up on some of these. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Versus Rick, who's just feeling nice and mellow. You got to watch it. You're almost as mellow as Liam was last week on News of the Weird.
Hey, it's a little hippy dippy.
I don't want you falling asleep over there.
Mm.
Okay, Jen.
All right. A recent series in the New York Times looks at middle schools. One article in particular focused on middle school teachers. Do middle school teachers need to minor or major in their subject? On what kind of criteria should they be hired?
Well, this is a very real debate, Jen, because under the No Child Left Behind Act, the law required middle school teachers to demonstrate subject matter knowledge. And a lot of states, that was the first time that middle school teachers had to do that. And in a lot of states, they had elementary school certificates. And now if you were teaching math in eighth grade, you had to actually have a math major or take a math test or go through the house hoops on and on. So, you know, this has recently been a big part of this debate. I mean, the problem is, how do we think about middle school? You know, you've got some success in these K-8 schools where you kind of extend the idea of elementary school into the middle school years. You got other people saying, look, if you don't learn algebra in eighth grade, your chance to get into college is very low. So therefore, we need people who know algebra. Rick, I don't know. I'm equivocating in this one.
No, I'm with you. And you know, it's what's interesting about No Child Left Behind on this is that on the one hand, NCLB pushed content specialization for middle school teachers. On the other hand, the testing apparatus of NCLB says, look, grades 3 to 8, we are judging schools based on whether or not kids are proficient in reading and math. That's the name of the game. And so the reality, of course, in a lot of the middle schools that are being hit by NCLB in those communities where it's really come into play so far, is that they are shifting the emphasis across the board to particularly reading preparation, reading and writing recovery. And there's no reason on earth that a science teacher needed to major in physics or chemistry or a history teacher in, you know, medieval Europe in order to do that. I'm all in favor of middle school teachers knowing content, but it matters a whole lot more if we're talking about really pushing the rigor on the upper end of the distribution and what we expect kids to know, then for the kind of remedial, the remedial and grade level emphasis and essential skills that we've been focused on in the last 4 or 5 years.
So you're arguing that you need less content knowledge to teach fractions than you do to teach
No.
Oh,
know.
Boy. Dude. Send in the letters now.
Oh,
buddy.
My gosh. Why? I stop.
Okay. That is it for Pardon the Gadfly, a very serious discussion all around, Rick.
Look at that.
I know. But you might be disappointing our listeners.
But we equivocated a little. I like that.
We did.
We equivocated a fair bit, actually.
Okay. Let us now turn to this week's interview with Education Week's Mark Walsh. Today on the show, we have with us Mark Walsh, who is a reporter at Education Week. He covers the courts for Education Week, and he's going to tell us about the case this past Monday about students' free speech. Mark, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Great to be here.
You know, Mark, you are adding to the credibility of the show tremendously by being on here, and a bona fide journalist. You know, sometimes we end up interviewing, computers or crazy people. Every once in a while, policy wonks, but I think this might be one of our first interviews with a real live reporter, so we appreciate that.
Okay. I'll try to live up to that billing.
That's right. You've got to be more interesting than a computer. So that's the challenge. All right, Mark. Well, big case in the Supreme Court this week, the so-called Bong Hits for Jesus case about a student who unfurled a banner with that slogan. A principal suspended him, and the student then sued, saying that his free speech rights had been infringed, and the Ninth Circuit agreed with the student. So now the Supreme Court has to make a decision about whether or not that kind of banner is protected under the First Amendment. Did I get that all right so far?
Yes, that is the case, and the basis for a very lively argument in the U.S. Supreme Court. The key question is whether the banner was protected speech under the First Amendment. Joseph claims he meant no particular message or political statement. It was just something ironic and funny and designed to provoke at parade that was going by the school.
All right. So let's talk about what you heard on Monday during the hearing. Did any justices tip their hand in terms of what they're thinking about how to decide this case?
Well, certainly, yes. The short answer to that is yes. And, to give a few examples, Justice Antonin Scalia, Chief Justice John Roberts, took the position of the school district, who was represented by Ken Starr, a former U.S. Solicitor General and the Whitewater Independent Counsel, who was representing both the Juneau School District and the principal in this case. They would accept the argument advanced by Mr. Starr and to some degree by the Bush administration that schools have broad latitude to restrict messages that interfere with their basic educational mission. Some other justices probably were not ready to go that far to the school side and might be more inclined to simply carve out another area of exception to the Supreme Court's famous Tinker versus Des Moines School District precedent from 1969, and they would perhaps accept the argument that this Bong Hits for Jesus banner with ran counter to the school district's policy against drug use.
Right. So let me ask a more fundamental question here. Why is it that high school students who are minors, are not 18, who clearly don't have other rights in our society, like the right to vote, why is it even that they have a fundamental right to free speech in the first place? I mean, was that questioned at all about whether, is that well-established precedent already?
It's a good question, but it's one that has been pretty much settled before this case, and it just so happens in this case, Joseph Frederick was 18 and a high school senior when he unfurled his banner, so he wasn't a minor. It wasn't a particular question in this case.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting. Well, Mark, that is going to be all the time that we have for today. I would point out that it sounds like from your coverage and others that all the justices agree that the principal should not have to pay any money, depending on how this case comes out. The student thought that the principal, because she infringed on his free speech rights, should have to pay a fine, and the Ninth Circuit seemed to agree with that. And that could have certainly had a chilling effect on principals feeling like they could make a decision and not worry about being personally liable for those kinds of decisions in the school setting. So
I agree with that on that question of qualified immunity, and I don't know that you have the time or necessarily want to go into all the fine points of that. Yeah. I would just like to throw in that there are some media coverage that, you know, does predict how the case might go one way or the other. I'm really not so sure how this case will go on the main free speech question. I think the court was really closely divided, and one justice, Stephen Breyer, was closely divided with himself about where he might end up on this case. So one to tune in closely probably in June near the end of the court's term.
Well, that's a great way to finish. It looks like we are going to need to follow this all the way to the end. So Mark Walsh from Education Week, thanks so much for joining the show.
Okay. Great to be here.
So what do you think, Rick? Give us some legal analysis here. How would you vote on the Bong Hits for Jesus case?
I'm a little concerned about the religious exclusion dimension here. I mean, I'd feel better if he'd also had Bong Hits for Allah and Bong Hits for, you know, Jehuda, kind of, you know, something that made
Jehuda?
It more Jehuda. I don't know, Jehovah, one of these guys. It's important. What I'm saying, this is my point. Here, my people have been excluded. I don't even know what we call the big guy, you know, or any of it. So I think it raises real issues about what kind of pro-pot banners we want to see kids waving outside of high schools.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have a problem with the pot part of it.
Where do you stand on this whole thing?
Well, I mostly think that it's really dangerous to have courts getting in to this discussion too far. And I understand the tension with the student speech rights, but I think you've got to, for the most part, unless it seems egregious, is to defer to the schools. Because the last thing we want is to have courts have a greater and greater influence on, you know, every decision that gets made inside our schools. And I think it's especially appalling that this principal could have to pay something out of her own pocketbook because she made a decision that even the Supreme Court is divided about whether or not she made the right call.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I stand, and I'm sticking by it.
Well, that's not an unreasonable stance. I do think it raises this issue when we define educational mission so broadly that, you know, part of the defendant argument in the court yesterday was that part of the school district's mission is to oppose drug use.
Mm-hmm.
That this becomes a defined part of the mission, and therefore the principal's obliged to shut this stuff down. You know, I mean, it strikes me that when you start to expand the charge of the school broadly enough, then you rope in all these kinds of unnecessary issues.
Yeah. Okie dokie. All right. It is now time for News of the Weird. Liam, what's weird this week? And please don't put our listeners to sleep.
Well, Mike.
That is much better, Liam. Good.
Turns out that teacher Lauren Berrios was fired by school administrators not because they thought she was a witch, but because she was condescending, odd, and made up stories about her husband being in a plane crash and her son losing his fingers in a VCR accident. Berrios originally alleged anti-witch discrimination in her $2 million lawsuit against Long Island's Hampton Bays School District, even though she maintains she is not, in fact, a witch. The district thought she was and fired her because of it. The jury found in favor of the district. Berrios' attorney said about the verdict, quote, "We're sad, but it proves Lauren is not a witch," unquote. "I stood up for my rights," said Berrios. She then flew home after the verdict, back to Atlanta, where she now lives with her husband and children and works as a teacher.
Did she fly home on a broom?
I left that open.
I know,
it was a good setup.
You knew I would go there.
I know.
Yeah, that wasn't even the script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah, thanks.
What was
the old Monty Python movie? How do you figure out if somebody's a witch?
Right, right. There was
throw them in the river.
Holy Grail, right? Where she's like, right, and if she floats, she's a witch. When you're tired of rocks, and if she sinks, she's not. But then she's drowned, so it doesn't do her so much good.
Yeah.
So her none of her children did actually lose fingers in VCR accidents. Is that?
No, I think that was made up.
That's reassuring. How would that happen? I mean, because VCR spindles, even if you've, when you've stuck your fingers in there, it's not like there's anything for your fingers really to catch on.
Sounds like this is personal experience here.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, very nice. But, you know, is firing her because of making up these silly little stories, is that a good reason to fire somebody? Or is it just that they
– Well, you know, if you're making up stories about your husband being in a plane crash, then you're probably doing this whole boohoo thing in the teacher lounge. Oh, my husband died in a plane crash. Bring me fruits and vegetables and, you know.
Yeah.
It just seems Confusing.
Yep. Liam's always making up stories around the office too. It's a little annoying.
How many?
He's like, you know, talking about celebrities that he saw on Saturday night.
Speaking of celebrities, yesterday, this is true.
See, here it comes.
This is true. I walked right by that guy who used to be chief of staff for Clinton, the short guy.
Which short guy?
Podesta?
Yeah. No. The first one.
McLarty?
No.
That was the guy his spokesman.
The guy that's got
Mac
the
McLarty
show.
McLarty was the first chief of staff.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Stephanopoulos.
Oh, McLarty. Oh, Stephanopoulos.
He was the chief of staff? No.
Who was he?
He was a special counselor.
Ah.
Domestic policy.
He was right outside our office.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, Liam. But again, So we believe stories. I don't really believe he saw George Stephanopoulos.
I don't believe Stephanopoulos ripped off Liam's fingers either.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Liam. That was much better delivered than last week's. And speaking of last week's News of the Weird, we do want to apologize for going over the line last week, or I should say explicitly, Rick going over the line. And me not,
I want to apologize then.
Yes, and me not doing enough about it when we were talking about the high school girls who performed the vagina monologues, and Rick asserted that he'd want to know whether or not they were attractive. It is, of course, not funny to talk about the attractiveness or not of underage girls. So we are all – yes, thank you. We are pigs. And we are sending Rick to sensitivity training next week.
That was
week.
A donkey.
I thought we were all going.
It's a donkey. I never know the difference between our pig and our donkey.
I thought we were all going to sensitivity training.
I'm going to go with you
all right.
As well. That's fine. We'll go. We're going to go together.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. And part of the sensitivity training is, of course, watching the vagina monologues. Now, I'm just kidding, but don't want to make any more jokes, so we are sorry to offend any listeners, and we do hope you'll forgive us. And, you know, Rick, you're going to wash out your mouth with soap.
I'm going to try to do better, baby.
All right. He is a reformed man. Well, good. On that note, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at www.edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.